Your radio, CIUT 89.5, the sound of your city.
And welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor. With me is Phil Conlon.
Yes, good afternoon. And
today we're going to talk about a unfolding story. It's some rather dramatic developments. The headline in the Globe and Mail is, India imposes security lockdown in Kashmir. Already that story is a little out of date, so that's why we're going to be talking to Zafar Benghash, and he is an author, a lecturer, an authority on certainly on this subject. And later in the show, we will talk to David Himbara about developments in Rwanda, and we might even talk about the Association of Paul Kagame and the NBA and the Toronto Raptors, so that what you might call local interest. You notice that President Trump has said that there's no place for hate and there's no excuse for hate, which means he doesn't read his own tweets. Everybody's aware of his tweets, and apparently he doesn't read them. He claims there's no room for hate. That's pretty much what he does for a living. We're joined now by Zafar Benghash. Hey, there is Zafar.
Hello. Yes, Phil, I am with you.
Thank you very much. Zafar Benghash is the author, by the way, of The Doomed Kingdom of the House of Saud. Might even be related to this story. We'll see. And he's the director of the Institute of Contemporary Thought. Zafar, I just read the headline from the Globe, and I told the listeners, I think it's already dated. This headline says, India imposes security lockdown in Kashmir. But according to the news that I'm reading, there's been a directive from the president changing the entire status of Kashmir. And as my understanding is that that's unilateral, because that happens to be a matter that has to do with the United Nations and the Security Council. But I'm asking you.
Yes, of course. The steps that the Indian government has taken by unilaterally abrogating two articles of the Indian Constitution, Article 35A, that relates to prohibition on non-Kashmiris to purchase property in Kashmir, because Kashmir has special status. It is, according to United Nations resolutions, a disputed territory. The full name of the state is, in fact, the state of Jammu and Kashmir. Mm-hmm. And there are 18 UN Security Council resolutions dated as far back as 1948 and coming as close as 1998. So there are at least 18 Security Council resolutions, and each and every one of them states that the final status of the state of Jammu and Kashmir should be determined through a referendum. Internationally supervised referendum in which the people would exercise their right to determine whether they wish to be part of India or they wish to join Pakistan. Now, the other article of the Indian Constitution is Article 370, which confers special status again on the state of Jammu and Kashmir. And under this article, this is, of course, according to Indian Constitution, that apart from defense, international affairs, and monetary policy, all other policies of the state of Jammu and Kashmir would be determined by the legislative assembly in Kashmir. Now, what the current government, the Indian government led by Narendra Modi, has done is to abrogate these two articles, not by presenting a bill in parliament, not by referring the matter to the people of Jammu and Kashmir, whose fate is being determined, but through a presidential decree. In other words, it's a constitutional coup, mm-hmm, that the Indian government has carried out. I'm sure your listeners, those that have been following your program regularly, would know that in Kashmir, the people have been in holding protests for decades. They do not accept Indian occupation. They have been demanding throughout this time that India should hold a referendum as it had pledged. It was India that had taken the matter to the Security Council in January of 1948, and it was India that had pledged that it would hold a referendum in Kashmir so that the people of Jammu and Kashmir can determine their own future. So what the Indian government has done today is it has turned its back not only on the Security Council resolutions, but on its own constitution. Mm-hmm. So we see that India is no longer a constitutional democracy. It is actually a dictatorship right now because the manner in which it is conducting itself. And of course, the other measures that India has taken, number one, it has deployed tens of thousands of additional troops in Kashmir. The Indian Air Force is flying regular overflights over the state. Number three, there is a complete lockdown of all the people in Kashmir.
Yeah, I've heard that they've arrested even the people who support them. A leader, Omar Abdullah, has been put under house arrest?
Exactly. Not only Omar Abdullah, who was the former chief minister, but Saida Mufti, another chief minister, who had, in fact, in the last term, was in alliance with the BJP to form a government in Kashmir. She has also been put under house arrest. So it is not only people that are demanding their right to hold a referendum, but even those people that are pro-India and they simply want a small measure of autonomy for the state of Jammu and Kashmir, they have also been put under house arrest. So as we speak, there is absolutely nobody allowed to come out of their houses. The internet has been shut down. All phone services have been shut down. All mobile services, mobile phone services have been shut down. And in fact, yesterday, the government, the local administration, urged people to stock up on food and water and fuel because they feared that this curfew can go on for so long because the people are so upset by what the Indian government has done that the moment the curfew is lifted, I can guarantee you that the people will come out by the tens of thousands to protest these illegal acts that the Indian government has carried out. I want to add one other thing, and that is that India is actually indulging in other illegal acts. There is something called the line of control between India and Pakistan. So that line of control basically divides the two parts of Kashmir, one under Indian control, the other on the Pakistani side. And in the last 3-4 days, the Indian army has been using cluster bombs on villages on the Pakistani side of Kashmir, and 4 civilians have been killed, including a young boy. Yesterday, in Kashmir itself, the Indian army killed 7 civilians in Kapwara district, which is a little outside Srinagar, the capital city. So what we see is a very, very dangerous situation in several ways. Number one, that it poses an imminent danger to the very existence of the people of Kashmir, both politically as well as physically. Because the Indian army has been given, there are certain laws that India has instituted when it comes to the conduct or misconduct of its troops. So these troops are given permission that they can shoot anybody on sight and there will be absolutely no accountability. Yeah.
Let me ask about that. Last time we spoke to you, one of the things we underlined is just how many troops are there, and the figure I remember something along the lines of 500,000.
No, it's more than that. There's actually 700,000.
They're already there, and yes. And so we're reading reports of they're sending, they say, paramilitary 10,000, 15. But my goodness, I don't even understand why they bother to mention the paramilitary if they've got that many troops already there.
Exactly. They have 700,000 troops over there, and now not just 10,000, but in fact 35,000. 10,000 are of a particular paramilitary force, but there are 25,000 other troops that have also been deployed. And as I mentioned, that the Indian Air Force has been deployed. It is flying regular flights over the state. Indian Air Force C-17 planes are flying regularly round the clock into Srinagar Airport, bringing military equipment, which includes armored personnel carriers, artillery pieces, and other equipment.
Mm-hmm.
And this is going on regularly, and this has been going on over the last 2-3 days. Mm-hmm. And of course, India realizes that the illegal act that it has undertaken by abrogating these two articles of its own constitution, that there is going to be a very, very strong reaction, not only from the people that are demanding the right to self-determination through a referendum, but even those people that have been supportive of India and were willing to work with the Indian government so long as they enjoyed a certain measure of autonomy. Even they are likely to be opposed to it, and it has been proven that the former chief minister of Kashmir, Saida Mufti, actually in a statement today, she spoke to the BBC, and she said that we were wrong to support India. We should have actually gone with Pakistan all along. And this is a person who served as the chief minister of Kashmir in alliance with the BJP party. And mm-hmm. so you can see that the manner in which India has alienated everybody,
mm-hmm.
every one of them in Kashmir. And I really, really fear that something really bad is likely to happen over there. We need to keep in mind...
And back in February, that we had violence. We had an Indian pilot was shot down as a result of fighting along this line, right?
Exactly. And the Indian pilot had actually violated Pakistani airspace, and his plane was shot down. And then, as a gesture of goodwill, Pakistan actually returned the pilot immediately, although it could have kept that pilot and demanded various things. But Pakistan did not wish to escalate the situation. But now we see that India has escalated the situation in a very, very dramatic fashion.
I
also
way,
want to add another,
I'm sorry.
Another point, and that is that as recently as July of this year, July the 10th of 2019, the UN High Commission for Human Rights issued a second report about the terrible situation of the people of Kashmir under Indian occupation. This is a 30-page report. You will recall that last year, also in June of 2018, the UN High Commission for Human Rights had issued their first report, and now this is a subsequent report. And in this report, the UN High Commission for Human Rights has said that India has taken no steps whatsoever to the very grave violations of human rights that we had identified in that earlier report, and we call upon the Indian government to take immediate steps to comply with these demands.
Mm-hmm.
Also, the Human Rights Commission, when the report had come out last year, India had immediately said, well, this is a one-sided report, and the UN High Commission representatives have not been to Kashmir. The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights actually had to write an op-ed piece in an Indian newspaper, the Indian Express, pointing out that their office had specifically requested India for permission for the High Commission's staff to visit the Indian occupied state of Jammu and Kashmir. And India had flatly refused to allow them that permission.
So
and
they
then
refused
they turn around
them.
And say, well, you know, they have.
And then they said, you didn't
there.
Come.
They didn't come, exactly.
Yeah. You but can't come also, in, but you've never been here.
Yes.
That's
but
pretty
he
good.
Also pointed out something, and he said, of the 388 references that we have given, each and every reference is taken from an Indian source, either from the Indian government itself, debates in Indian Parliament, statements of the Indian, you know, Supreme Court, statements of Indian military officials, statements or reports of Indian human rights organizations, as well as of Kashmiri human rights organizations. So he said that everything is based on reports that the Indian government itself has accepted. So he said that India is in no position to complain that this is these are unverified reports or things like that. Mm-hmm. So you can see that, you know, India is playing a very, very dirty game in the whole situation, and it thinks that it can get away with it because it feels that the international community will not pay much attention to it. And regrettably, that seems to be the case, because internationally we haven't heard from any world leaders making any statements about this illegal act that India has indulged in. Although there have been a lot of media coverage of this situation, most of the major newspapers, including here in Canada, the Globe and Mail, the CBC, Global News, everybody has covered and are covering this story, including, you know, in England, for instance, the BBC and British newspapers, in the U.S., the New York Times, the Washington Post, all of them have given extensive coverage to this, and they see the risk of a nuclear war breaking out between India and Pakistan, because both are nuclear-armed countries.
Yes. Here at this time, the United States is putting, it says, maximum pressure on the Islamic Republic of Iran, where it does not have a bomb, and says it does not intend to have a bomb, and has been thoroughly supported in that by international investigations. Meanwhile, you have two nuclear powers, both of whom acquired a bomb without anybody asking any questions.
Yes.
And now they're at each other's face, throat.
Yes.
Very absolutely. Dangerous.
And in fact, you know, the other problem is that India refuses to accept third-party mediation. As recently as July 22nd, when the Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan was in Washington, D.C. to meet Donald Trump, Trump himself said that he'd be willing to mediate between India and Pakistan over this disputed territory, and this dispute has gone on for so long. When he heard about it, that it has been going on for 72 years. And Trump even mentioned that at the G20 meeting in Osaka, Japan, a couple of weeks prior to that, that the Indian Prime Minister had asked him to mediate about the Kashmir dispute. And when Trump said that, immediately the Indian government said, no, our Prime Minister had never said anything like that. We don't accept that, and this matter has to be resolved bilaterally between India and Pakistan. And when Pakistan says, okay, if you want to resolve it bilaterally, the first step is that we sit down and hold a dialogue regarding this so that we can come to some understanding. And then India says, no, we don't want to have a dialogue with you. So, it's a very, very strange situation.
It's dangerous. I have to ask you, or we should emphasize again for our listeners, this was, as far as the international community is concerned, it is actually part of the agenda, part of the development of the United Nations in the elimination of colonialism. And the area was considered disputed, and it was resolved by the United Nations. This was, and is taken up, am I right, annually?
Yes.
The matter comes up on UN's agenda. So for India to say, no, we've decided this unilaterally, that's actually in violation of an international agreement.
Exactly. Absolutely. And India is in violation of almost every article of the, you know, international agreements, international human rights law, international law, as well as the UN Charter.
Yeah. By the way, we have a trend that's unfolding. People concerned about nuclear war, possible, you know, these things deteriorating, should remember President Trump, who says he might mediate. He stood by while Israel said, we're taking East Jerusalem. As a matter of fact, he says, I recognize that. And then he recognized Israel's taking of the Golan Heights.
Yes.
So
yes.
This is a dangerous, you know, one state gets an idea from another state that they can, he did that, I'm going to do that.
Exactly. And in fact, there are very deep and close relations between India and Israel. India is the largest customer of weapons imports from Israel. And there are, in fact, Israeli military as well as Mossad advisors operating in Indian-occupied Kashmir. And so what you see, the pattern you see in Kashmir is in fact a mirror image of what the Israeli occupation forces are doing in occupied Palestine, in the sense that...
They're both thumbing their nose at the United Nations.
Exactly.
And yet countries like Canada and the U.S. are mum while they do it, which means they're giving them a green light.
Yes. And I also want to mention with respect to Canada's role that when this issue first came before the UN Security Council back in 1948, Canada at that time was a member, a rotating member of the Security Council, and in fact the Canadian representative, General McNaughton, was the president of the Security Council at the time when this issue came up. And it was under his term as president of the Security Council that the first resolution about holding a referendum in the state of Jammu and Kashmir was passed.
Yes, that was... By the way, that's something Canada should be proud of and should be insisting on now, because everything was appropriate. He said there should be no occupying forces present, and the people being given a right to express their views and vote.
Exactly.
Which any reasonable person would say that is the way to do it. That was agreed to by Prime Minister Nehru. I noticed today that they're beating their chests, the leaders of the presiding party in India, saying, we're ending the mistake of Nehru.
Yes.
We're ending it. Well,
yes.
What, by fiat?
Yeah, this is just absolutely brazen disregard for any legality, this total disregard for international law, total disregard for international humanitarian law. In other words, India's actions are completely illegal. There is no leg that they can stand on. And I think it is now time for the leaders in the Western world to stand up and call India to account. Mm-hmm. They simply cannot allow it to continue as it is doing. And I want to emphasize that, not only is the situation extremely dangerous for the people of the state of Jammu and Kashmir, but that there is a real risk that there may be a war that would break out between India and Pakistan, because there is a lot of anger on the Pakistani side also.
Oh, you could see it on Twitter. The language is highly inflammatory.
Exactly. I mean,
unfortunately, as tempers rise, people's willingness to accept mass annihilation of each other goes right along with it.
Exactly. And in fact, on the Pakistani side of Kashmir, there is, of course, a state government. The prime minister of the Pakistani side of Kashmir, which is referred to as Azad Kashmir, he has called upon the people to be on full alert that anything can happen, arising out of India's illegal action under the mm-hmm. Indian occupied state of Jammu and Kashmir.
Yeah. We're speaking, by the way, to Zafar Benghash, and Zafar is the director of the Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought, and is the author, by the way, also of The Doomed Kingdom of the House of Saud. Let me ask you a geopolitical question. I've seen some speculation that some background of this is India's unhappiness with Pakistan, or Pakistan with India, in Afghanistan. Is there something going on there that is impacting this?
Yes, of course it is. And that is that India had hoped that by joining the U.S. in terms of the war on Afghanistan, not by sending its military forces, India flatly refused to do that because it realized that they would be chewed up by the Afghans. But India has invested heavily in Afghanistan. It has invested something like $4 billion. And for more than a decade, the U.S. was exerting enormous pressure on Pakistan, accusing it of all kinds of, allegations, etc. And then finally, America realized that if it wants to withdraw its forces from Afghanistan, it has to do it in conjunction with Pakistan, because the American forces would have to come through Pakistan. They have to take all of their equipment through Pakistan. Hmm. And so when Prime Minister Imran Khan was in Washington, D.C., Trump mentioned that we need Pakistan's help to extricate our forces from Afghanistan. And while we are speaking, the Taliban and the American representative, Zalmay Khalilzad, who's a special point man for Afghanistan, they're holding negotiations in Qatar right now. And this is the eighth round of discussions. And under these discussions, the Americans have, in principle, agreed to pull out their forces. And they have also, but in return, they are asking the Taliban that Afghanistan should no longer be used for by various groups to carry out attacks against the U.S., etc. And the U.S. is also calling on the Taliban to hold negotiations with the government of Ashraf Ghani. But the Taliban say that that government is a puppet government. It has no representation in Afghanistan. The people of Afghanistan have not elected it. It's just a farce. Mm-hmm. And but they have said that we are willing to hold negotiations with them, not as an Afghan government, but they can come as individuals, Afghans, representative individuals, and others. We can sit down and we can talk about the future of Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. But the Taliban are insisting that once we have a specific timetable for the withdrawal of American forces from Afghanistan, then we will sit down and talk with these other people. And so what has happened as a consequence of this is that India has lost in Afghanistan. It no longer has any, or it will no longer have any standing in Afghanistan. And because of that, it is so upset that it is now acting totally irrationally in Kashmir.
Mm. That is, I'm really glad we asked that, because, you know, when you suddenly hear these second, third issues pop up and you realize they could be the primary matter. Yes. In other words, if India continues to lose out in Afghanistan, it becomes a little desperate.
Yes. And you see, the other problem is that, unfortunately, the current Indian government is a very racist and fascist government. I'm not exaggerating. In fact, this particular
Well, the opposition today said they have just murdered the Constitution.
Exactly.
By the way, aren't there going to be severe internal problems?
Yes, of course. The opposition is inside India is up in arms. They have said that this is a complete, it's a very dangerous move that India has embarked upon, and that it would have very dangerous repercussions for India itself at the international level. But the other point, of course, is that as far as this ruling party is concerned, it actually is a party whose ideology is very close to the Nazi ideology. In fact, their literature, if one studies their literature, we find that they have expressed great admiration for Hitler's ethnic cleansing and final solution. It's in their literature. You know, that great Indian writer, that courageous woman that I really take my hat off to, Arundhati Roy, has written about this. She has spoken about this.
And she's had her life threatened as a result.
She was threatened with death and you know, these goons in India. Mm-hmm. And at the present time, inside India, Muslims are being hacked to death. They are being beaten to death. They are being publicly lynched. And this is going on. There are videos available on the internet. And yet, regrettably, there is very little criticism of India's conduct, because these vigilantes, yes, they are referred to as cow vigilantes, because for some strange reason, these people believe that the cow is their mother and therefore it's sacred. Well, you know, they can believe whatever they want, but that does not give them the license to go and then start, lynching Muslims in public. Mm. And there have been many gruesome acts that have been perpetrated.
Certainly, when leaders start to talk about tearing up constitutions and correcting old errors, and inevitably, ordinary people will start taking things into their own hands.
Exactly.
What we're seeing in El Paso and Ohio is a similar thing, where the leaders use inflammatory rhetoric, and it sets minds on fire.
Yes.
It's very dangerous.
Absolutely. That's exactly what is happening in India as well. In fact, in India on a much greater scale, because it's a vast country of 1.2 billion people. And many times you don't even hear about these things, that these are happening over there. And in many, many cases, the stories that have come out is only because somebody standing with a cell phone has filmed what is taking place, and that has been put on the internet, and that's how we learn about it.
Thank goodness for the internet.
Yeah.
Zafar Bengash, it's been very edifying. We will certainly be back in touch with you soon, as we hope the story gets better for everybody.
Yes.
And we thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for the opportunity, Phil.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Zafar Bengash, his book is The Doomed Kingdom of the House of Saud. A very good book, by the way. I urge everybody to obtain a copy of that. This is the Taylor Report. It is CIUT 89.5 FM, the sound of your city. And we are on SoundCloud and we are on Facebook. We're going to take a musical break with our favorite musician, and we will be back to talk to David Himbara.